welcome to EI Talks. I'm Angus Riley. We are speaking today in Washington, D.C. at the Henry A. Kissinger and the Question of World Order Conference, hosted by the Axon Johnson Institute for Statecraft and Diplomacy and the Henry A. Kissinger Center for Global Affairs at Johns Hopkins. 70 years ago, in 1954, the French army was defeated at Dien Bien Phu in Vietnam, and the Geneva Conference divided the country into North and South Vietnam. 10 years later, the U.S. Congress passed the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, permitting President Lyndon Johnson to use American troops in Vietnam. Joining me to discuss the Vietnam War is Frederick Logeval, Professor of History and International Affairs at Harvard University, and the author of, among other works, Embers of War, The Fall of an Empire and the Making of America's Vietnam, and JFK, Coming of Age in the American Century. Frederick, there are different versions of the Vietnam War. There's the anti-colonial struggle, there's the war for empire for the French, and then there's the war against the communists. But you, in your book, Embers of War, root the story back to 1919, after the First World War. What is the significance of that moment?
Well, of course, the war, the First World War, or the Great War, as it was called, is important in and of itself for European colonialism. And though the European powers came out of that war thinking that they had strengthened the empire, I think we can now say that, in fact, it had been weakened. This took a while to manifest. One of those figures who thought that he had an opportunity here at the end of the war to press for his country's independence was, of course, the fellow we would later come to know as Ho Chi Minh. So I start the book there because Ho Chi Minh seeks an audience with Woodrow Wilson, the American president, and with the other leaders of the victorious powers at Versailles. And he even rents a morning coat for the occasion because he wants to look his very best. And he's hopeful. Maybe if I can get a few minutes even with President Wilson, I can make my case. He'll be sympathetic. After all, he's talked about making the world safe for democracy. He has talked about national self-determination for peoples, his own country, that is to say the United States, born out of an anti-colonial reaction. So he'll know, and maybe he'll be sympathetic. And of course, he did not get the audience with Wilson or any of the other powers. They probably didn't even notice him. And so it's a kind of what-if moment, and I have a few of those in my book. This is one of those where you can imagine, what if Ho had been able to make his case, could the story have been different?
And because it really captures the sort of dilemma, the paradox of Ho, that nationalist or communist that seemed to pervade the Vietnam War. And do you think that it is a key moment in that debate?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think you're quite right to say that that is a contentious debate, and it remains one among historians. Communist? Nationalist? What was he? And it's one that I address at various points, not only in that book, but in other works. And some part of me wants to say that for Ho, it would have been the wrong question, in the sense that I think he would have said that he was both. That he did come to believe a little bit after the period we're talking about now, that is to say, I think during the course of the 1920s, certainly into the 30s, I think he came to believe that Marxism-Leninism was what his country needed. He was committed to that philosophy, no question. So in that sense, he's a communist, no question. But I also want to say that it was his country that he was talking about. In other words, that Marxism-Leninism represented the best path of economic development for his country, but it was his country. So I would say, more than communist, he was first and foremost a nationalist. He was after national independence for his country. That's the sort of foundational objective throughout his long life.
And so if the debate of a nationalist-communist isn't the right one, what did French and American policymakers and observers miss about a figure like Ho as the through line through
the period? Oh, that's a very good question, actually. What did they miss? I mean, I think they missed the degree to which, for a time at least, eventually they got this, but for a time they, I think, missed the degree to which he had, to use a loaded term, he had a legitimacy and his movement had a legitimacy in Vietnam that no one else could quite match. because of his role in opposing the Japanese, who of course took over for a period of time in World War II, or at least took de facto control and then complete control, the role played by Ho and his Viet Minh in opposing the Japanese and then opposing a French return to Indochina was really of great importance. And I think that was to a degree missed by first French and then U.S. officials. Mm. I think they also missed, maybe this applies more to the Americans, missed the degree to which he really hoped that he could have American support, solicited American support, wrote letters to Truman that were not answered by the State Department or by the administration. And it's another, I suppose, potential what-if moment. Mm. Because certainly the United States under first Roosevelt and then Truman was not eager to support European imperialism. It was not that they were wanting a French return to Indochina, but they missed, at least to a degree, how determined Ho was and how determined a great many Vietnamese were to allow the French to reclaim colonial control over their country.
Yeah. So the South Vietnamese regime that emerges from the Geneva Conference in 1954, it's run by a sort of Catholic aristocratic elite, and it does also face immense religious difficulties with the Buddhists in South Vietnam. How do the North Vietnamese and the communists deal with religious differences in Vietnam? How does that factor into their approach to the war?
Well, the country is, of course, deeply divided by the time we get to the end of the French War. And it's divided on various grounds, among them religious. It's an overwhelmingly Buddhist country, but there's a sizable Catholic population. What happens after the French defeat in that great climactic battle at Dien Bien Phu, then at the Geneva Conference, the country is split. It's supposed to be temporary, but it's split between North and South. With the DRV, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, led by Ho, in control in the north, and then the Diem government, Catholic, No Dinh Diem, in control in the south. And one of the things that happens is an extraordinary migration of Catholics from the north to the south, because they understand, with some justification, that remaining in North Vietnam will likely mean that they'll be persecuted, that this government is not going to be sympathetic to their views, to their religious positions, their desire to practice their religion. And even if the dangers are to some extent exaggerated, partly by American intelligence officials like Edward Lansdale, there's some reason to be concerned, I think, for sure, among Catholics. And so you see this extraordinary migration, one of the biggest, I think, in human history, of people going from north to south. And a much smaller number, people are voting with their feet, in other words, a much smaller number go from south to north. And that speaks, I think, to the power of what South Vietnam represents for a time. Of course, then an insurgency develops and things begin to fall apart. But there is that moment when you can see how a separate South Vietnam and a separate North Vietnam might coexist in a tenuous form for a long time to come.
And in 1954, is it that, do you think that the French lose or the Viet Minh win? Because that is, it's actually a hugely important debate for the Americans as well.
Oh, of course it is. Yeah. It's another good question. You know, it's an easy answer, but I'll use it, which is that it's some of both. It's clear that in strict military terms, the French won more battles than they lost.
Yeah.
But I think they came to see what the Americans would ultimately come to see and maybe should have seen more clearly on the basis of the French experience, which is it doesn't really matter so much. Individual engagements. Losing a piece of territory for a short period of time is not a problem for the Viet Minh. The French don't have enough manpower to retain the areas they've taken. So what would happen time and time again is that the French would take a spot, a piece of territory, wouldn't have the manpower to hold onto it, so would leave, and then the adversary would flow back in. And this would happen time and time again, and so sometimes there would be engagements over the same piece of territory multiple times. What it means is that over time, 52, 53, 54, is that the Viet Minh is gaining steadily more territory. The French are losing the will to continue the fight. One of the little known aspects of this story, which I write about, is the degree to which it's the United States, not France, that is saying, we need to continue this fight. We do not want to negotiate with Ho until we've improved the battlefield position. We need you, the French, we need you to hang in there. And so the Americans are actually more committed to this war than are the French themselves. They're paying now for the war substantially. It's become, in a sense, an American war, which, by the way, Ho Chi Minh understood. Ho understood, and he said to his colleagues, in so many words, I'm paraphrasing, but he said, you know, our principal foe now in our struggle is, in fact, the United States, not France. So I think it's a combination of the French losing. I think it's General Giap, the principal Viet Minh commander, and his subordinates also winning militarily. And then the final thing to be said about this is that at the Geneva Conference in 1954, under pressure from the Soviets and the Chinese, their main allies, the Viet Minh has to take a smaller piece of the pie than their battlefield prominence would suggest that they should have. And that's in part for political and geopolitical reasons. They have to take half a loaf now, hope that they can get the rest of it later, ideally through these negotiations that are supposed to take place in 1956.
I think one of the great tragedies of Vietnam is that in sort of the popular imagination, it's not only is it a war of choice, it is a war of a series of choices, of a series of decisions to escalate from the period you just discussed through to 1964 and the Gulf of Tonkin and then 1965. And America always seems in control of its decisions there, in sending advisors, in supporting the Diem regime, and then not supporting the regime, and then gradually escalating from that.
Yeah, I think that's a good summary of what happens after the French. It's a gradual French departure. Doesn't happen in one fell swoop in mid-1954. But little by little, the French withdraw. They retain a certain amount of cultural influence and economic influence, but it's more and more now an American show, building up South Vietnam, defending South Vietnam, supporting South Vietnam's decision to forego the elections, bypassing the elections. The reason the Americans do that is they're pretty convinced that Ho Chi Minh would win any national election. So, and then an insurgency develops in the latter part of the 1950s. And it becomes a bigger and bigger military struggle. And as you say, the United States faces a series of choices. Beginning, I suppose you could say, in a way, in 1956, in bypassing the elections. That's a choice. They could have insisted on that taking place, but they supported Diem's decision. And then at key moments thereafter, steadily, when they come to a fork in the road, do we increase the U.S. involvement or decrease? Or I suppose you could stay in the middle of the road and not change anything. But at each point, they choose upping the American presence. The critical decisions to, and we can go into more detail on this, but obviously the decisions by John F. Kennedy, who I believe is a skeptic on the war in many respects, Kennedy's decisions in 62 to substantially expand American involvement, military and otherwise, very important. And then the decisions in 64, which you mentioned, by the Johnson administration, this is after Kennedy's assassination, to not only further increase U.S. involvement, but to begin secret contingency planning for a drastic escalation of the fighting in 64. Johnson wants to keep that on the back burner until after the election, which he does, though the Gulf of Tonkin incident happens during the campaign. But then in 65, the big Americanization happens. There is also a North Vietnamese escalation of the fight. And so now you have large-scale war about a decade after the French defeat.
The Vietnam War endures in part because every war since, every American war since, is almost a rehashing of the Vietnam War. And what you think about how America should have fought, whether it was with counterinsurgency, or whether it should have withdrawn or something, is intensely revealing. Yeah. I mean, you think that people like Edward Lansdale and the biography of him, The Road Not Taken, yes, and stuff, and that there is that pervasive sense of missed opportunities and things that could have gone differently.
Yeah. No, I think that there is. And for me, those missed opportunities are mostly in terms of disengagement, avoiding war. I have argued at length that Lyndon Johnson had legitimate choices, yeah, in 1964 and 65, not just in hindsight, but crucially in the context of the time. That is to say, we can know this from the archives, from the other evidence that we have, that he didn't have to do this. Yeah. And in fact, he himself, we now know, had deep, deep skepticism, not only about whether the war could be won with escalation, but whether it was even necessary to try. That's the more chilling part of this. He says in 1964, for example, in May, to McGeorge Bundy, we have this captured on tape, "I don't think it's worth fighting for, and I don't think we can get out," which is an extraordinary sentence when you think about it. In that same conversation, "What the hell is Vietnam worth to me, and what's it worth to this country?" So he himself, I think on some level, is aware that he has this choice, that he doesn't need to do this. And that's true, I think, not just under him. I think there are other choices that could have been taken that admittedly, in short-term political terms, that is to say in domestic political terms, are challenging, but they are there. And it is a series of forks in the road. It's a series of counterfactual questions that we can pose about this involvement. Some might argue that alternatives could have been taken to actually increase the chances of winning the war. That's a whole different debate. I'm less persuaded by those, but those kinds of arguments also exist.
So if Johnson is trapped, as is, I think, the perception in what you're saying, what is he actually trapped by? In November 1964, yeah, he wins the largest landslide in American history. The Gulf of Tonkin Resolution is passed overwhelmingly. What does he have to lose?
Yeah, it's a question that I'm still puzzling over, I guess I could say. You know, 3+ decades after starting work on this. I mean, I've spent a lot of time on this question. As you say, an enormous landslide victory against Goldwater, huge majorities in both houses. The Senate Democratic leadership is privately skeptical of the need for an escalation. His own vice president, Hubert Humphrey, in February of 1965, in an absolutely amazing memorandum, Humphrey is basically saying to him, in so many words, "Mr. President, don't do this. Don't escalate the war. You don't need to," again, for the reasons that you said, Angus, about the size of the election victory, majorities that you have in Congress. Don't do this. If you do it, Humphrey says, you're going to divide the American people, you're going to divide the Democratic Party, you're going to make your own position more difficult politically. So, as you say, why is he trapped? I think he feels trapped because he misunderstands, in my view, the domestic political context in which he's operating. Lyndon Johnson was, as everybody acknowledges, an absolute master inside the Beltway. But I think outside the Beltway, he was much less sure-footed. And people like Humphrey, I think, ultimately understood Democratic precinct politics across the country and understood the mood of the country better than Johnson himself did. So there's a miscalculation. I think there's a fear on his part that he would maybe have a difficulty passing his Great Society domestic legislation if he was perceived as backing down in Vietnam. I'm not persuaded by that argument, but I think he held that argument. And maybe there's also psychologically an aversion on his part to being perceived as having failed, as having been a loser in this struggle in Vietnam. And to his credit, in his defense, this was a commitment that went back to the Eisenhower administration, indeed to the Truman administration, in terms of backing the French. So it's a longtime American commitment to preserving a non-communist bastion in at least part of Vietnam. So there would have been a short-term political cost if he had backed down. But I think Humphrey was absolutely right. That would have been much less problematic for him than the course that he chose.
I mean, there's a lot of focus on the pressure he's getting from Doves, but does Johnson, is he getting pressure from the right, from the Hawks? No. People like Curtis LeMay, Barry Goldwater as well, people who want to escalate further. I mean, to use a phrase in the modern parlance, do they think that they're the adults in the room?
Yeah. There are pressures from the right in 64 and 65. I was shocked in my research how little such pressure existed. And I think I've been through the materials pretty well, pretty carefully. That includes newspapers, that includes the congressional record, that includes oral histories, and of course, and it also includes archival documentation. They're a tiny minority. Richard Nixon, we would also include among that group. Nixon still wants to run for president again. He had lost to Kennedy in a narrow election in 60. He is making noises in 64 and 65, basically saying, will the president have the presence of mind to really see this through to the end? And so he's feeling some of that pressure from the right, but it's not very heavy. It's less than one would expect, less than I think would come later on. And let's remember, even though they won't do this publicly, privately, he's getting more pressure from Democrats, especially in the Senate, and this includes the leadership, Russell, Mansfield, Fulbright, his own vice president, as we've said. He's getting pressure, more pressure from that side, which is to say, let's not make this an American war, Mr. President.
Yeah. And so American troops officially come to the war in March 1965. But it seems like the backlash comes quickly. When you read the narratives of the Vietnam War, it feels like by 1967, there's the Fulbright hearings and things. It does seem to pivot quickly. But do we have a warped perception of what the reckoning with the war was because we now accept it to be a failure?
To some degree, I think we do. I think you're right in one way to say that things shift pretty quickly. In a different way, I would say they didn't shift very quickly, which is to say I'm surprised, Angus, by how patient the American people are. It is sometimes said that Vietnam demonstrates the limits of America's, of the public opinion's patience with this kind of a war. On the contrary, I would say that it's remarkable how much Americans are willing to see a stalemated war continue year after year after year. And so though there is, as you point out, the beginnings of questioning, the Fulbright hearings in 66, certainly one measure of that. But long after that, Congress is very reluctant to really speak up. So it's almost like a one-off. It takes much longer, I think, for America's campuses to become particularly restive. So yes, it begins to shift as the war is stalemated, as Americans come home in larger numbers in body bags. There's an increase in this turmoil at home, but not as quickly as I would have expected.
Yeah. I mean, 1968 is commonly considered the turning point, the Tet Offensive in January. What really, to you, is the significance of that year and what changes? Because the war goes on for longer afterwards than has been up to that point. Yet why do we consider that the turning point?
Well, you know, one of the things that I do with my students is I ask them to identify key years in this conflict. And I tell them I want no more than, say, five principally important years. And probably every student who's ever responded to this on an exam or whatever will have 1968 as one of those years. And no wonder. I mean, think about, we have the Tet Offensive, an effort by North Vietnam to fundamentally turn the tide, to deal a kind of savage blow to cities in the South with the hope, really two hopes. One is to get the American public to sour on the commitment. So they're trying to influence American opinion. And of course, they're also trying to destabilize the Saigon government, maybe get an uprising among the South Vietnamese people and then win the war. That doesn't happen. So militarily, one would have to say that the Tet Offensive failed for the North Vietnamese. Politically, it's a more interesting question because it does, in fact, have an effect on American domestic opinion that I think is really notable. In that sense, one can say that it succeeds. And of course, the first casualty, if you will, or the leading casualty is Lyndon Johnson himself. It's not directly as a result of Tet. It's part of a broader set of developments relating to the war in the first 3 months of 1968. that caused him to make this extraordinary announcement. March 31st, I shall not seek and I will not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president. Absolutely mind-blowing for most Americans, assertion by the president. Everybody knows that Lyndon Johnson wants to be reelected. Everybody knows that he's salivating at the thought of winning a big election victory that fall. He's just dropped out. It's huge. He also announces, and Hanoi announces, that there will be negotiations. That makes the year important. So, I mean, you're seeing here how 68 just matters. And then, of course, the fact that Hubert Humphrey, who ends up getting the nomination, who has, since he wrote that amazing memo in 1965, has turned around and become a supporter of the war, now, as the nominee, is needing to back away from that support and has to navigate that very interesting fall campaign, therefore, waged by Humphrey against Nixon. And the final element here is that some part of Lyndon Johnson, I think, almost wants Nixon to win this election, because Nixon, he believes, even though he's from the other party, competing against his own vice president, Hubert Humphrey, Nixon is more likely to continue the war and therefore justify everything that Lyndon Johnson had done. It's, as you point out, an incredible year.
Yeah. I think one of the greatest disparities between the American theory of victory and then its actual impact on North Vietnam is around bombing, because also in March 1965, I think there's a bombing halt as well. And the Americans invest huge amounts of focus and energy into the bombing campaigns, and particularly in the early 1970s as well under Nixon. Yeah. But there is a disparity between how that seems to impact the North Vietnamese. And why did the Americans do that? Why did they focus on that? Why did they not believe that it wouldn't actually impact the North Vietnamese?
Just clarify this. So you're talking about the bombing or the bombing halt?
I mean, I think the Americans clearly recognize that strategic bombing is a huge part of the war effort, essential for them.
Yes.
And they believe that it is almost the lever to pull against the North Vietnamese. And then, for example, in Argument Without End, the Robert McNamara discussion book, the North Vietnamese say, well, it really didn't do that much because we're such a rural country. Yeah. And I don't understand that feels so obvious.
Yeah.
Why don't the Americans understand that?
Yeah, you're quite right that the United States for a long time put huge emphasis on the bombing campaign, that the aerial war, according to this, I don't know whether to call it conventional view, was going to put sufficient pressure on the North Vietnamese that Hanoi would feel compelled to throw in the towel or at least negotiate on America's terms. Even though from a pretty early point, it was clear the strategic bombing was not having the hoped for results. And Robert McNamara, obviously Secretary of Defense, one of the leading architects of Americanization, McNamara himself saw, we now know, that this just isn't really doing what we want it to do. And even after the negotiations begin in Paris in 68, and there supposedly is a reduced level of bombing by the United States. In fact, after a time in the summer of 1968, the bombing increases again. And I think undermines the notion that Lyndon Johnson was prepared at this point to negotiate some sort of agreement. Because the North Vietnamese could say, well, why is the bombing actually increasing then? And the number of targets has increased, the spread of the bombing has expanded. And then, as you point out, under Nixon and Kissinger, the bombing remains ferocious, not only on targets in North Vietnam, enemy-held areas in South Vietnam, but also, of course, Cambodia and Laos.
Just to finish up, you're writing your second volume of a biography of JFK, and you could write the story of Vietnam, and there's a romantic sense of it, of the tragedy of it all, the hubris, the mistakes, the loss of Kennedy, who may not have escalated, the loss of his brother, who may have ended the war. How do you look about that? What does that tell you about how we remember the war?
The Kennedy part of this story is both, I think, important in historical terms and interesting in terms of, I suppose we could say, what might have been. I mean, Jack Kennedy, and I talk about this in the first volume of my biography, he went to Indochina in 1951 as a congressman and understood, I believe, in a very penetrating way that the French are not likely to win this war. that you're not going to be able to defeat revolutionary nationalism by military means in this part of the world. By implication, I think JFK is saying it's not only the French who can't do this, no Western power can do this, meaning we, the United States, can't do this. I think he retains that skepticism all the way through to the end and his assassination in Dallas. And yet, he maintains that commitment. He expands it, as we said earlier, in 1962. So this is something I have to figure out and deal with in the second volume of my biography, this paradox. How do we reckon with this? What would he have done had he lived, which is sort of the mother of all counterfactuals, and it's one that I've written about in various places. That matters. And then Robert, as you point out, as he's facing the decision about whether to run in 1968, and he hems and haws, arguably waits too long to get into the race, but Vietnam is central to that decision. So you're right, the Kennedys, one could tell the story of America and Vietnam, in a sense, through these two brothers and what they experience. And to a degree, I'm trying to do that very thing in my project.
You've been listening to EI Talks, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast. Engelsberg Ideas is funded by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation for Public Benefit. The sound engineer is Gareth Jones, and EI Talks is produced by Alistair Benn. Till next time, thanks for listening.